Thank you and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to plunge right in at 1:32, I note, to our topic today, at least the first topic today. And the subhead in my book for this is the initiation of physical force as evil. Now, you have to assume that we have covered all the derivative virtues at this point, because this is the very end of the chapter on virtue. And I'm turning in conclusion to a widespread vice, the initiation of physical force against other men. This vice represents the antithesis and destruction of the virtue of rationality itself, and therefore of every other virtue and every human value as well. Now, to refrain from force is not necessarily a mark of good character. You can be utterly evil, yet recoil from wielding a fist or club yourself. For example, the coward who attempts to destroy others by psychological or ideological, not physical means. But to initiate force is to commit a major evil, and one which in the long run is an inevitable result of irrationality. Now, physical force means coercion exercised by physical agency. I could give you many examples, but keep in mind such things as punching a man in the face, incarcerating him, shooting him, seizing his property, as just several of a whole range of examples. Initiation means starting the use of force against an innocent individual, one who has not himself started its use against others. And we'll return to these two points, physical and initiation, and amplify them later, but that's just to get us started. Since men do not automatically accept the same ideas or value judgments, no code of ethics can escape the present issue. Explicitly or otherwise, the moralist has to tell men how to act when they disagree, assuming that the people involved don't decide simply to part and go their separate ways. And in essence, there are only two viewpoints on this issue, because there are only two basic methods by which one can deal with a dispute: by reason or by force. By seeking to persuade others to share one's ideas voluntarily, or by coercing others into doing what one wishes regardless of their ideas. Objectivism, of course, countenances only the method of persuasion. Now, I hasten to add, to clarify widespread confusion among objectivists, that it is not true that all persuaders are honest men. To use persuasion in the sense involved here does not necessarily mean to be rational. There are many manipulators, even destroyers, who seek to bypass logic and get what they want from others verbally, not physically, but by playing on their feelings and doubts. In the dichotomy we're here setting up, these are not initiators of force, however irrational they otherwise may be. Even these creatures, so long as they abstain from force, leave their victims free not to fall for the racket, free to think, to employ logic in solitude, to decide the question for themselves, and to act accordingly. We are talking now about force as the evil. And here is the key to understand the whole issue of force. The man of force, in attacking a person's body or seizing his property, I include that, the man of force in attacking a person's body thereby negates and paralyzes his victim's mind. Now, on the face of it, there is a paradox here. All a man of force can get at is the body. And yet the essence of his crime, according to objectivism, is that he paralyzes the mind. If you understand that, you understand the whole case against force. And now let us develop it. The mind is a cognitive faculty. Its function is to perceive reality by performing a complex process of identification, a process of gathering factual evidence and integrating it into a conceptual context in accordance with the rules of logic and an objective methodology. Now, I'm assuming that you know that this type of conceptual cognition presupposes a volitional consciousness, presupposes a sovereign consciousness, and that cognition is a process that has to be performed egoistically, individualistically, independently. Of course, that's something I discuss under epistemology in the book, but I'm counting here on your general knowledge of objectivism. But since cognition presupposes conceptual cognition, a sovereign, volitional, egoistically functioning consciousness, it is not a process that can be forced. And here I want to quote the key passage from Miss Rand. Quote, a rational mind does not work under compulsion. It does not subordinate its grasp of reality to anyone's orders, directives, or controls. It does not sacrifice its knowledge, its view of the truth, to anyone's opinions, threats, wishes, plans, or welfare. Such a mind may be hampered by others. It may be silenced, proscribed, imprisoned, or destroyed. It cannot be forced. A gun is not an argument. An example and symbol of this attitude is Galileo, unquote. To order a man to accept a conclusion against his own judgment is to order him to accept as true something which, judging by everything he knows, is not true. It's either arbitrary in his judgment or outright false. And this amounts to ordering him to believe a contradiction. It is like demanding his agreement that red is green or that 2 + 2 = 5. You can torture an individual, force him to mouth any words you say. You can even drive him insane in the process. But you cannot make him believe these mouthings. Volition does not extend to that. Volition pertains to the issue of initiating and sustaining the activity of thought. To the extent that a man does choose to think, however, he has no choice in regard to the conclusions he reaches. No matter what the bribes dangled before him or the threats, a thinker has to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Even if he tries his utmost, he cannot will himself to accept as true that which he sees to be baseless or mistaken. We can sum up like this point. It is impossible for a man to engage in a cognitive undertaking or to reach a cognitive result, such as an idea, while brushing aside logic and reality. It is impossible to engage in cognition while brushing aside reality. Yet this is precisely what the criminal who seeks to force a mind demands of his victim. The victim, therefore, if he can't escape, has only one recourse: to stop dead internally. In other words, to cease functioning as a cognitive entity. When reality is decreed at gunpoint to be out of bounds, a rational mind simply has no way to proceed. This is the reason why the greatest eras of human history have always been the freest. And it is the reason why science, art, invention, and every other expression of fresh human thought fails to arise or vanishes in a dictatorship. Just as a man cannot abuse his own mind with impunity, just as he cannot, without wrecking his cognition, begin to evade or accept the arbitrary or default on integration or defy his sense perceptions, so he cannot escape the consequences when others seek to force on his mind the same abuses. Now, of course, the victim does not have to give his inner consent to the forcer's evil demands. He doesn't have to agree to start lying to himself. But there is one mental penalty the victim cannot avoid. If and to the extent that someone's gun becomes a man's epistemological court of final appeal, replacing the law of identity, then the man cannot think. Now, I want to stress that this is not primarily a matter of moral integrity or virtue on the victim's part. It is an issue of philosophical necessity. The point is not that a slave should choose to defy his captors. Obviously, he should if he can. The point is that, qua enslaved, he literally cannot perform the processes essential to human cognition. He cannot think. Of course, he can still smuggle into his life some remnants of secret thought if his captors leave him alone long enough, and if he doesn't try to express his thought in reality. Now, an eloquent example of the relationship between force and thought is offered in the climax of Atlas Shrugged. And this is, in fact, the whole meaning of the climax of Atlas Shrugged. John Galt is unable to come up with any plan to save the country, even though a gang of thugs is screaming for such a plan and seeking to extract it from his brain by force has strapped Galt to a torture machine. By Galt's knowledge, there is no way to achieve prosperity under a dictatorship. And neither torture machine nor death threat can alter the absolutism of this fact. Galt accordingly does not change his convictions. He doesn't try to consider them from some new angle. He doesn't seek out any compromise. He doesn't try to think up any ideas to satisfy his torturers. He simply does not use his conceptual faculty in regard to the issue at all. And the point is, he does not because he cannot. He literally cannot. Nothing will make the contradiction these brutes desire become possible, and he knows it. The brutes, therefore, are left helpless. They can kill him, but they cannot achieve what they desperately want, to start and direct a process of thought within their victim's mind. They cannot turn a volitional process into a deterministic response. Or if you want it even simpler, what they are trying to do is to turn an action into a reaction. And that simply negates the whole essence, nature, and function of the mind. What men achieve through coercion is the opposite of a new idea. Like all autocrats throughout history, the thing that the forcers work to derail and thereby immobilize is precisely their victim's mind. They make their thrall, to the extent that he is in thrall, stop thinking. Now, I want to point out that I've been discussing the effects of force on a reasoning mind. An irrational man functions differently under these conditions. By a process of evasion and rationalization, he can comply mentally with just about any decree of others. He can bring himself to believe, if you call it that, any contradiction he chooses. But this sort of inner state flows from the rejection of reason. As such, it has nothing to do with human knowledge or with the convictions of a rational person. In the cognitive sense of the terms, an irrational man's mental contents are not really beliefs or ideas at all. They are much closer to the jabbering of a parrot. All right, now let's develop the case to the next point. We've been talking about trying to force a mind. Man is an integrated being of mind and body. Any attempt to force his mind, therefore, necessarily represents an attempt to rule his actions. That is, his actions in reality, his existential actions, and vice versa. Any attempt to rule his actions necessarily means the attempt to force his mind. Now, I want to clarify this further aspect of the issue by considering force that aims to elicit from the victim not primarily thought or belief, but existential action. And a simple example would be a gunman who says, I don't care what my prey thinks, I just want him to hand over his wallet. Now, the essence of force in this aspect is to make a man act against his judgment. The victim still sees what he sees, values what he values, knows what he knows. The forcer, however, bypasses the victim's cognition, making it useless in practice. When the gunman threatens your money or your life, the owner still knows perfectly well to whom the money rightfully belongs. But if he does not choose to risk death or physical harm, the threat is what has to determine his action. His own conclusion, however clear, logical, compelling, becomes impotent. The same applies to countless other cases we could give as examples. It applies to the conclusions of a teenage boy opposed to a particular war, or a publisher dealing with sexual material, or a physician dealing with the elderly, or a person under totalitarianism dealing with anybody. It applies to all these and all the other cases of people who have to act under the threats issued or about to be issued by some governmental agency. In all such forms and degrees, from private crimes to the incursions of the welfare state to full-scale dictatorship, the principle is the same. Physical force, to the precise extent that it is threatened or wielded, denies to its victim the ability to act according to his own judgment. And such treatment is tantamount, in Ayn Rand's words, to forcing a man to act against his own sight. That's her expression. Now, this obviously places the individual, this kind of treatment, in an impossible metaphysical position. If he does not act on the conclusions of his mind, he is doomed by reality. If he does, he is doomed by the forcer. The virtue of rationality has two aspects, as does all virtues. It requires one to think and then to act in accordance with his thought. What you should see in summation is that force clashes with both these requirements. Force used to change a man's mind acts to stop his mind and thus make it inoperative as the source of his action as well. Force used to change a man's action shoves his mind and thus the whole process of cognition into the junk heap of the purposeless. In the one manifestation, the brute works to detach his victim's consciousness from reality and therefore from life. In the other, from life and therefore from reality. So it's an all-embracing assault. And thus Ayn Rand's formal conclusion in Galt's speech, quote, whoever, to whatever purpose or extent, initiates the use of force is a killer acting on the premise of death in a manner wider than murder, the premise of destroying man's capacity to live, unquote. And when she says wider than murder, his capacity to live, she means destroying his basic means of survival, the rational faculty itself, that is, destroying in the sense of paralyzing, making it unfunctional, incapable of operation. Or as she states the point in her next paragraph, quote, force and mind are opposites, unquote. Now, like all forms of unreason, the initiation of physical force represents the antithesis not only of the primary virtue, rationality, but of every virtue, because, as I stressed last time, they're all interconnected. The brute attacks in his victims every aspect of the moral life, while at the same time rejecting each in regard to his own life. So he's 100% immoral across the board. For instance, in unleashing a process of force, he is acting to nullify his victim's independence, while becoming himself a thorough dependent whose concern is the conquest not of nature, but of men. Or what about the virtue of integrity? Well, the brute seeks to prevent men from upholding rational principles or acting by their guidance, and he seeks it not on the grounds of a principle, but as is true in every case of evil, without grounds. He seeks it by an act of evasion and a whim worship. What about honesty? He orders his victims, when he feels like it, to accept and pass on to others any lie he commands. What about justice? He throws out the very concept of desert. His method of dealing with men is to extract the unearned from them for the sake of benefiting the undeserving, whether himself or others. And as to the virtue of pride or moral ambitiousness, I remind you of Ayn Rand's aphorism, morality ends where a gun begins. Now there's one more derivative virtue that I didn't mention yet in this connection, productiveness. Since force and mind are opposites, the brute stifles at the root the process on which his own survival depends, the process of men acting to create material wealth. At the same time, when a society accepts the rule of force, that rule breeds its own adepts. It replaces the creators with the kind of men who believe that what counts in life is not brain power, but firepower. And then to quote from Francisco's money speech, then the race goes not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is the standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket. And then that society vanishes in a spread of ruins and slaughter, unquote. Now, such a denouement illustrates the fact that man's life depends on his use of reason. It illustrates the fact that there is no dichotomy between value and virtue. No dichotomy between value and virtue. Virtue, according to objectivism, is man's means of achieving value. Whatever is destructive of virtues, therefore, is necessarily destructive of values as well. In judging any instance of the evil under discussion, therefore, the initiation of force, as in judging any act of evil, there is no trade-off to consider. Now, I assume here that you understand that the pragmatists take the view that before taking any action, you should basically make a list. All the good points that will result from the action go on one side, all the bad points go on the other, and then you have a trade-off, a cost-benefit analysis, and you take the one that comes out ahead. Well, if you want to look at it that way for objectivism, when you made that list, if the act of initiating force is the thing, on the positive side, after racking our brains to infinity, would be zero. There is not one item. There is no value against problem to weigh. And the principle here is no good is achievable under any circumstances or for anyone by means of the initiation of force. Because force and mind are opposites, we could put the conclusion this way. Force and value are opposites too. Now, to understand this point fully, philosophically, you must remember the objective view of value as against the intrinsic or the subjective approach. I assume your familiarity with this, but just to remind you, in the objective approach, values are facts. Facts as evaluated by a mind in accordance with a rational standard. And that, of course, contrasts with the view that values are some sort of divine commandments, or that they simply represent subjective feelings, personal or social. To repeat, values in the objective interpretation are facts as evaluated by a mind in accordance with a rational standard. Value, the very concept, therefore, implies a valuer who concludes by a certain process of cognition that a given object will sustain his life. You cannot therefore sunder the term value from the requisite process of cognition in the mind of your intended beneficiary. You cannot sunder it from the person's own rational consideration, thought, judgment. To force an individual, however, is precisely to disdain and bypass this process of cognition. No result of the initiation of force, therefore, can qualify as, quote, good. No result. It is not, quote, good in relation to the victim, and since there are no conflicts of interest among rational men, it is not, quote, good in relation to anyone else either. We can look at the same question from this point of view. In the objective approach, value is a form of truth. It's a species of truth. It's a form of grasping or recognizing reality. And just as you cannot force truth upon a man, so you cannot force values or virtues upon him. A series of sounds uttered by someone at gunpoint is not a truth. It is a noise he is compelled to make. An object embraced at gunpoint is not a, quote, value. An action performed at gunpoint is not a, quote, virtue. These three concepts, truth, value, virtue, denote not the purely physical, but an individual's recognition of reality. And this requires a process of volitional consciousness on his part. It requires the individual's own choice and agreement. Now, I'm going to take a minute to read in full the crucial passage on this point from Ayn Rand, because I don't know how many times. Every single word is absolutely vital. I'm sure you've read it dozens of times also. But hear it in the context of what we're saying, and then I'm going to elaborate further. But this is really the whole thing right here, from Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. Quote, "An attempt to achieve the good by physical force is a monstrous contradiction which negates morality at its root by destroying a man's capacity to recognize the good, i.e. his capacity to value. Force invalidates and paralyzes a man's judgment, demanding that he act against it, thus rendering him morally impotent. A value which one is forced to accept at the price of surrendering one's mind is not a value to anyone. The forcibly mindless can neither judge, nor choose, nor value. An attempt to achieve the good by force is like an attempt to provide a man with a picture gallery at the price of cutting out his eyes. Values cannot exist, cannot be valued outside the full context of a man's life, needs, goals, and knowledge." Unquote. There's very few cases in the book where I have that lengthy a quote, but it's impossible to omit a word of that, as you would appreciate if you tried. Now, let's concretize that. And I think the most obvious concretization of Ms. Rand's point is a totalitarian state. The citizen's own understanding of reality, along with their own value judgments, is irrelevant to their lives in such a case. It's irrelevant because state force, not individual cognition, is the principle governing men's actions. To the extent that a person is moral, therefore, in other words, is rational, independent, uncompromising, purposeful, proud, his life becomes simply unendurable. Such an individual has only three alternatives, which are defined in We the Living. He can attempt to flee the country, as Kira did. He can kill himself, as Andre did. Or he can try to make the conflict between force and mind endurable, as Leo did, by nullifying one of the two clashing elements, the only one within his power, which means drowning his mind, whether by alcohol, drugs, promiscuity, or some other form of escape. To the extent that a man succeeds in this endeavor, he becomes the forcibly mindless of Miss Rand's quotation. That was her phrase, the forcibly mindless. In other words, he becomes the living dead, like Leo at the end of the book, who loses the capacity to know any longer what is being done to him or to care. Now, no course of action that such a person takes can be, quote, right, no matter what he does. The term is no longer applicable because he has renounced the root of virtue. And for the very same reason, no object he goes through the motions of attaining, no object can be for him a, quote, good. Right and good are moral terms. In this context, morality is a means to self-preservation. The forcibly mindless are outside that realm. And the way I put it in a terse statement is this: the terminology of self-preservation is not applicable when the self has disappeared. Which I think captures the point. The terminology of self-preservation here being right, good, and all the other moral terms. Now, a totalitarian state is an obvious example, but I want to consider an even more instructive, although I hasten to say purely hypothetical and impossible example. But it's the type that Platonists raised, so let's take it. Let us suppose that the force wielders restrict their coercion to only one significant issue, such as choice of career. And let's say that they reach their verdict that a given boy should go into medicine. We'll pick that. They reach that verdict, the forcers, only after administering a panoply of psychological tests to determine the boy's own interests and aptitudes. They give him the Minnesota test and this test and that one. So suppose further, let's give them the biggest benefit of the doubt, theoretically you can imagine. Let's suppose that the boy himself is actually mistaken in his choice. He thinks that some form of art is the right field for him, even though, as a matter of fact, his basic subconscious value judgments actually point to a career in medicine. Only he himself has not discovered this fact, does not believe it, and cannot be persuaded to accept the forcer's conclusion. Now, that is as good a case as you can make for the propriety of force or for its leading to a good result. And my point is that even granting this whole impossible setup, the philosophical point remains true. Even if medicine would be the right field for this boy, were he to choose it himself, the act of forcing it on him makes it wrong. Now let's see why. If a boy goes into medicine through the exercise of his own judgment and choice, he thereby brings a certain cognitive and emotional context to the assessment of his experiences in the field. Since he has decided to pursue certain objects, he can relish them when he reaches them. For example, the new knowledge he gains, the new skills, the fascinating cases he encounters, the dramatic cures. And he can also accept with equanimity, as the price of these positives, the stretches of boredom or other negatives with which any career is replete. And parenthetically, if his choice of career is mistaken, the process of introspection will give him abundant evidence of the fact. But now project the case that the boy is forced into medicine under threat of jail or physical harm. In that case, the context he brings with him is reversed. The positives, so-called, are no longer positive. They are not values to him because he has not evaluated them as such. And as to the negatives, the back-to-back emergencies, say, the litigious paranoids among his patients, the 48-hour shifts, the relentless atmosphere of accident, disaster, blood, pus and death. Well, he can only have one feeling, This is the nightmare men forced me into when they tore out of my life my passion for art. Now I ask, can you think of a better way for manufacturing hatred of a career? Is there a better way to make a mind give up all ambition? Would you want to be treated by this kind of physician? Is this the means of achieving, quote, value in human life? Now, obviously, value, like truth, is contextual. Neither one, neither value nor truth, value being just a form of truth, can be divorced from a mind's knowledge and judgment. And that is why, whatever the force wielders decree, they're wrong. Whatever they say, it's the wrong thing. No value can be achieved by an assault on the valuer. No creative result can be achieved by the agencies of destruction. No good can be achieved by the methods of evil. What the initiation of force can achieve is only the negative. Frustration in the victim, resentment, despair, passivity, non-motivation, non-evaluation, non-thought, along with the bloody existential results that ultimately flow from such negatives. And this principle is clearly universal. It applies not only to governmental coercion, but also to private crime. Not only in regard to career, but also to marriage, friends, hobbies, even movies. And not only to an isolated boy, but to any intended beneficiary, past or future, individual or social. Now that is the essence of the objectivist argument against the initiation of force. But the concept of force is widely misused today, so I want to clarify in a little detail what is and is not an act of force within the context of the present discussion. And I want to begin by elaborating on the point that the evil is the initiation of physical force. There is only one way to attempt to force a man's mind, by directing the force to his body or property. By purely intellectual means, no one, neither an individual, nor the whole society, nor any part thereof, such as TV advertisers, can coerce a man. Because intellectual means would have to consist of some kind of statements or arguments, whether true or false, good or bad. And this would be a process of persuasion, not of coercion. A man may be thoroughly confused by the claims and exhortations of others. But confusion does not have to breed mental passivity. A volitional being, so long as he's left unmolested, is free to initiate a cognitive process. He has the power to struggle to untangle his confusions and thereby replace them eventually with truth and clarity. The only kind of so-called social pressure that cannot be resisted by intellectual means is that which does not rely on intellectual means. If some group, governmental or private, tells a man, either you agree with us or we will clean out your bank account, break your legs, kill you, then a cognitive process on the victim's part is insufficient and ineffective. No such process can avail in counteracting the threat. This category of threat or harm, physical force and nothing else, is what constitutes coercion. This is what negates and sweeps into the discard the victim's mind. Now, similarly, a man may be disappointed by others, rightly or wrongly. He may be unable to persuade them to agree with his ideas or to satisfy his desires. But disappointment does not attack his body or negate his mind. It is not an indication that he has been coerced. So a man cannot properly say, since nobody has offered to pay me a larger salary, my boss forces me to take this job at $5,000 a year. No one has an unchosen obligation to confer wealth or jobs on this person. Nobody owes him a living. Nor can anyone in a free society stop him from looking further or from improving his skills or from working to start his own enterprise. If an employer who offers a certain salary tells him, take it or leave it, and he agrees to take it for whatever reason, including utter desperate poverty, that is the opposite of force, the literal opposite of force. It's an instance of a voluntary relationship between the men, an instance of trade. We can sum up this point this way. Coercion is not coextensive with frustration caused by others. It pertains only to those frustrations which men cause by invoking the methods of brutality. Now, turning to another point, I want to take care of violence, because everybody's against violence today. Not against force, of course, just violence. Violence names a particular form of force. Force that is swift, intense, rough, and or accompanied by fury. That's my distillation of four dictionaries. The moral issue we have been identifying, however, is not a matter of form. The evil is coercion and anyone who initiates it, whether he is a wild-eyed mafioso, hitman brandishing Tommy guns, or a prim little bureaucrat with his weapons on call but discreetly out of sight. To denounce violence but not the initiation of physical force as such is to imply that only the first of these men is evil. This would mean that the rule of brutality is moral if carried out decorously, with periodic elections, all the right documents filled in, and the agony of the victims kept out of the newspapers. And that is exactly what today's politicians and intellectuals do believe, and what they are trying to insinuate into the public mind. Now, another clarification here. Just as the physical is not limited to the violent, so it is not limited to the direct use of force. An example of the indirect use would be the gaining of someone's property by means of fraud. In such a case, any consent the owner may have expressed is nullified. What the owner does not consent to is the transfer of goods that actually occurred. Morally, the crime here is indistinguishable from plain robbery. The difference is only a matter of form. Of course, it's up to the field of law to define all the different forms of physical force, direct and indirect, including all the variants of breach of contract. Now I want to focus on the issue of initiating physical force. That's all I have been condemning. To use force in retaliation against the individuals or nations that started its use is completely proper. Using force in retaliation means using it not against the innocent, but to stop criminals or aggressors. The ethical difference is the same as that between murder and self-defense. The moral rule in this issue, as in all issues, is not a sweeping commandment, but an absolute prohibition within a specified context. Contrary to the claims of pacifists and other advocates of unconditional love, forcible retaliation does not mean, quote, sinking to the brute's view of morality. You don't reason with a jungle beast, you can't. But that doesn't mean sinking to an animal's viewpoint. It means recognizing the facts of reality and acting accordingly. The same applies in dealing with the man who, by his own choice and action, declares that he can no longer be treated as a rational being. When men use force against such a self-made beast, they are treating him in the only manner he himself permits. Nor do the retaliators acquire values thereby. They merely protect what they already have. You remember Galt's statement, a hold-up man seeks to gain wealth by killing me. I do not grow richer by killing a hold-up man. I seek no values by means of evil, nor do I surrender my values to evil, unquote. Now, objectivism's censure of the initiation of force is a conclusion. Its premises are all the basic principles of the objectivist ethics, and beneath that of the objectivist metaphysics and epistemology. By the same token, the age-old brutality worship of mankind's intellectuals is a conclusion which rests on a long chain of premises. Most obviously, it rests on the theory of altruism. altruism endorses and even demands the initiation of physical force. When the needy or their representatives use coercion against other men, they regularly explain that their action is obligatory. It is the needy's only means of ensuring that some recalcitrant individual whose duty is self-sacrifice carries out his moral obligations, that he actually gives up to the poor the unearned goods and services he is born owing them but is wrongfully trying to withhold. At the same time, and with complete consistency, altruism in its commonest forms disapproves of the retaliatory use of force. The Bible, for instance, advises you to resist not evil, but instead to go with an aggressor against your will an extra mile, which policy, it notes correctly, is a form of self-sacrifice. But altruism is not the fundamental root of brutality worship. That root lies in the essential philosophy of unreason. More specifically, it lies in the epistemology of intrinsicism and subjectivism, and in the concept of value to which these theories lead men. The epistemology of each of these schools makes coercion a necessity of human life. Now, I assume you know the theory of intrinsicism. In essence, it reduces cognition to revelation from God. And in regard to revelation, rational argument is futile. The only ultimate means of resolving men's disputes, therefore, is physical force. In this kind of view, force is the prerogative of the viceroy of God, or the philosopher king of Plato, or whoever else possesses the ineffable insight denied to the masses. Subjectivism draws the same kind of conclusion from the premise that knowledge of existence is impossible. In this theory, there are no external facts or reality-based rules of logic to which disputants can appeal, so they face only the dead end of might makes right. In other words, by denying the objectivity of cognition, both these philosophies rule out, in principle, the path of persuasion as against coercion. Now let's look at the concept of value inherent in these two theories, because it gives a fundamental moral sanction to the initiation of physical force. Their epistemologies make force necessary. The ethics to which those epistemologies lead makes force good. By the very nature of the good these two schools believe, coercion of the innocent is permissible and even beneficent. It can be a form of moral idealism, an act of nobility, a virtue leading to the achievement of a value. Now, intrinsicism, if you know its ethics, holds that value inheres in, or is intrinsic in, that's the word, inheres in objects as a mystic attribute, independent of any human goal, consequence, or evaluation. In other words, a thing or action is good in and of itself, apart from any relation to man. Well, if so, value is obviously independent of human knowledge or judgment. Well, if so, you can force the good on a man and benefit him thereby. Or to put the point another way, if virtue is obedience to commandments, then it's proper to compel such obedience. Because in this approach, the thought processes of the men one compels are irrelevant. Theirs is not to reason why, theirs is but to do and die. Aptly put. Now, subjectivism leads to the same moral conclusion by a different route. If value is the product of arbitrary human evaluation, then again, value is independent of human knowledge, because in this version, there is no such thing as knowledge, whether of fact or of value. So anyone is justified in ramming down the throat of others whatever he feels is, quote, good, and it thereby is good. Courtesy, not of God's whim, but of his own. In both cases, the moral essence is the same. Whether in the name of self-abnegation and or, quote, self-assertion, value is divorced from the mind and therefore is regarded as achievable, not by means of reason, but by means of brutality. Now, as a rule, when the advocates of this moral creed see its consequences in practice, they are unmoved. Practicality had never been their motive. Consequences, shrugs the intrinsicist, are irrelevant to ethics. Consequences, shrugs the subjectivist, are whatever I claim they are. And thus the professorial apologists of fascism and communism, who watch corpses piling up across decades and continents, yet remain undeterred. The killing, they say, reflects the awesome imperatives of history. That's the intrinsicist types. And anyway, they say, we feel that the party is right. Subjectivism. Which brings us to the most popular argument in favor of the initiation of force. An argument regularly offered by intrinsicists, subjectivists, and alike. And that is the argument that force is necessary because men will not listen to reason. Now think about this one. Force is necessary because men will not listen to reason. Or to put it another way, brutality is the antidote to irrationality. Well, that is exactly like telling a person, I'm going to bash your brains in order to assist you in using them. If it's true that men are irrational, and parenthetically, most are less so than the intellectuals who attack them, but if they are irrational, the cause is the kinds of ideas that dominate the world, the ideas and the mind-destroying statism which they promote. The solution is not force, but its antonym, a theory and then a country of reason. If by some kind of magic, men could abolish only a single human vice, and they selected in this regard the initiation of force, it would not make everyone moral or prevent every injustice, but it would transform the world. It would mean at one stroke the end of crime, slavery, war, dictatorship. It would mean the utopia that people so often fantasize or at least make speeches about. The unbreached reign of peace and of human dignity. Vice, however, is an effect which cannot be ended by magic, but only by uprooting its cause. Just as evil, including brutality on a world scale, follows inevitably from one kind of basic philosophy, so good on the same scale can and will follow only from the opposite philosophy. To abolish vice, establish virtue. To establish virtue, enshrine thought. To enshrine thought, identify its relationship to reality. In other words, have a correct epistemology and metaphysics. Nothing less will stop the Vandal hordes who are now, for the second time in history, closing in on the West. Nothing less will cut out the rot spreading from within the heart of civilization itself. Nothing less will prevent the fall, not of Rome this time, but of New York. Thank you. Now, I'm going to do something unusual today. I timed this so as to be able to start Independence Today, not right this moment, but this period I want to start it, because I want to reach the point of being able to give you a homework assignment, and you'll have 2 days to try to come up with the answer. So I'm going to have about 15 odd minutes of questions on force. And then I'm going to start on the next topic on which you're going to need extra time anyway, because I could never squeeze it all into one day. Okay, go on force, right on the front, yes.
Okay.
Now someone has got to tell me that at 22:03 approximately, will someone take that responsibility, because I'll still be answering questions on force. Go ahead, yeah.
What is the place of consent in the definition of force For instance, there seems to be the same amount of force involved in assault and battery or a boxing match, or let's say rape and lovemaking. And isn't consent an important defining characteristic?
Well, is consent essential to the issue of force? Absolutely. Force is physical compulsion. It's that to which an individual, which he doesn't want, to which he disagrees with. If I say, you give the example of a boxing match, the person is not initiating force against me. It's morally a complete difference. If I'm sitting here standing here giving a lecture, and he comes up and punches me on the chin out of the blue, as against it, he says to me, I'd like to put on an exhibition. We'll both collect some money, or we'll test out our, skills, etc. Do you agree? And you say yes. And I say yes. And he says, do you understand that it means a blow might land in your chin? And I say, well, that's the price of the game, okay? And I go there. He's not exerting force on me, even if he punches me in the mouth, obviously. And now you give the example of rape versus lovemaking. Rape is obviously not a form of lovemaking, but you're trying to suggest that there's... Well, certainly consent makes a difference. I mean, if the person were unconscious, the issue of force wouldn't come up. If man had no consciousness or no power to choose or decide, then the issue of force wouldn't come up. It's because he has a volitional consciousness which has to decide on his course. And the evil of force is that it is saying you must go against your consciousness. Once you've consented, that's the end of the... There's no sin then. Now, you may be irrational to consent, but that's a different vice. Yes?
What is the proper action, moral action, towards the killing, the vicious killing of Colonel Higgins in Lebanon?
You changed the subject to foreign policy. What is the proper moral action toward the vicious killing of what was he, corporal?
Colonel
Higgins in Lebanon. Well, I don't want to go into foreign policy. My views on that are very straightforward, very easy to understand. They either are self-evident or they require four volumes. If you want it in the self-evident version, break off all diplomatic relationships with all communist countries, starting with Soviet Russia, institute an economic boycott, militarily enforced, of the whole communist world, and efface Iran, militarily. Raise it from one end of the country to the other. That's it. Now, as a matter of fact, if you did do that, you wouldn't even get around to dropping the bombs on Iran, because once the Soviets, supporters of the terrorists that are operative in Iran, were undercut and cut off, they themselves are now declaring that they're starving. So you can only imagine what would happen if we said we know it too and we know why, and it's going to get worse. Now, if I were in charge of American foreign policy, you could... Well, if I had a CIA, and even if I had to work covertly, none of which I agree with or approve of, because there's no reason why you shouldn't do it all overtly, but if you had to do it covertly, I would give assistance and arms and aid to every single constituent of the Soviet Union, every one of those republics that is yearning to break away and start its own ethnic socialism. I would say, great, here's $1 million, Estonia, you break away, and Soviet Georgia and the Ukraine. I would do everything I could to foment what's obviously happening and have them return to the Balkanization that was the normal state of that part of the world for eternity before they were forcibly united under Russia. And then they would no longer be a threat to anybody but themselves. Then they would spend their lives killing each other off, as they always did, and everybody would be happy, them included. Now, I'm not changing the subject, because Iran is not acting independently. Iran would not dare to support the terrorists and take the stance it does if it was not getting its support from Russia. And this is known by everybody in the State Department and in the government and everywhere. So I wouldn't even bother talking about Iran. Iran is not even a fly on the map. It has to be swatted. But that is not even worthy of discussion. Now, I don't want to go on further on foreign policy because we only have 8 minutes left on force, let alone foreign policy. Yes?
Is it legitimate to initiate a preemptive strike when someone, another country or another person is about to initiate force on you?
Absolutely. Is it legitimate to initiate a preemptive strike? You obviously have foreign policy on your mind. Against another country when they are about to initiate force against you? Yes, if you have objective evidence. And you wouldn't have to ask this in a political context. The same could be true of your neighbor. And let's keep it on that level because this is supposed to be ethics we're talking about here. If your neighbor gives you objective evidence that he is about to do something in the form of initiating force against you, you do not have to. Now, I don't know the exact law here, but I'm talking what properly should be the case. You should not have to wait until he does it. For instance, suppose he gets a Tommy gun, he leans over the backyard fence, he points it at you, he has his finger on the trigger, and he says, "Get ready to meet your maker." Now, anybody who would say in a case like that, "Well, he didn't initiate force yet," I mean, that would be fantastic. On the other hand, if he's simply watching, let's say, The Untouchables on TV, and you say to yourself, "This, for all I know, could put him in a warlike frame of mind," and you go in and smash his TV set as a preemptive act, that's improper. So it's up to a proper philosophy of law. It's not up to philosophers, but to a proper philosophy of law to define what constitutes an objective threat. And a threat is a crime over and above the act of force. In other words, it's a separate crime. And it's up to the philosophy of law to define what is the crime of threatening force. But I believe, if there's lawyers who can correct me, that is even on the statutes, I believe, that the threat of force is itself a crime. But you have to define, you know, what is a threat, and I'm certainly not going to do that in this question period, so you may as well put your hand down if that's what you're about to ask. Yes?
Dr. Tito, some of the techniques that they use in concentration camps to undercut a person's sense of his own ethical sense would be to, at the force of a gun, tell him to either break his neighbor's leg or be killed, or throw his neighbors into an oven. What is the moral status of any action taken under
No, trial? What is the moral status of an action taken by a prisoner in a concentration camp who is ordered to initiate force, that's what it amounts to, against another prisoner? No morality is applicable. There is no right or wrong in such a situation because there's no choice. In such a situation, this is where Ayn Rand's point that morality ends where a gun begins. Whatever a person does is as justified or unjustified because you're in conditions which are antithetical to life. If he were to take the line, I'm ordered to kill this innocent person and I want to try to remain alive and escape and kill him, even the victim couldn't blame him because he knows the circumstances under which they're living. And that he has no choice. On the other hand, if he were to take the line, I'd rather not kill him, and hopefully they'll kill me and I'll get out of this. That is acceptable. There is no way to put men into conditions under which life is literally impossible, and then say, define the principles by which they should live. And they can't. There is no such thing. That's one of the things that destroys the victims of concentration camps, precisely that whatever they do, it's no good. There is no way to do anything right. And that's why they attach, the ones that survive, pick one or two actions which are tremendously minor, but which they could get away with, that they regard as right, and cling to them with a passion. For instance, washing. As an attempt to say, well, there's one thing in the form of self-preservation or self-sustenance which I'm going to do in defiance of everybody to have just that fragment of my view of life alive and real. And the people who do that sometimes are able to survive. But the whole institution, of course, of a concentration camp is sustained and made possible by force. Nobody enters that voluntarily, not even the guards, you know, who were drunk all the time and hated the assignments. So I think that's enough on that point. At the very back, in the blue, or were you describing your hair?
No, I was just...
Yeah. Oh, you were describing your hair. All right. Yeah.
One who persuades another to use force as responsible as the one who's persuaded?
Is one who persuades another to use force as responsible as the one he persuaded? I don't think so, but I can't say that I've given that much thought. It would depend what was the nature of the persuasion. But if it was purely, if it was truly just persuasion, that is, it wasn't a situation of instigating a riot, which is a definite legal. See, you're trying to force me into the philosophy of law, and I'm equally trying to avoid going into it. There is such a thing as instigating a riot, which can legitimately be a crime. That is, getting a crowd in an inflammatory situation, you know, and then saying, let's kill, you know, the author of this book. And then they all run. You can, even if you yourself don't pull the trigger, can validly there be charged as an accessory before the fact, or whatever the legal term is. Now, if you're using persuasion broadly enough to encompass that, then, in other words, anything anybody does to instigate crime, if it objectively instigates it, and is not purely intellectual communication, you see, that's the crucial line you'd have to distinguish. When do you become an accessory, and when are you merely expressing a viewpoint? On the other hand, you could not, for instance, say, take a professor who preaches socialism and say, who does it peacefully from a pulpit to an audience and so on, say, well, this guy is using persuasion to encourage people to initiate force and to seize property, and therefore he's initiating force, or he's an accessory to a crime. That is not true. Because if you did that, then, of course, you would obliterate all free speech. Then you'd say the only people who can speak are the people whose ideas lead to conclusions that are consonant with objectivism. And that would mean objectivism is wrong, because one of our principles is freedom. So lawyers would have to make a very exact distinction, and I couldn't give you a yes or no to the question as you worded. It would altogether depend on whether the person is actively involved as an accessory, or is simply advocating a viewpoint. Okay, one more question on force, and then we're going to go to independence. Now, somebody who's got a real juicy one, not on philosophy of law, not on foreign policy. That eliminates most of it, right? All right, yes.
All right, you focused a great deal on the harm that the...
I didn't even point at you, but all right, go ahead. Yeah.
You focused a great deal on the harm that the aggressor does to the victim. You focus more on the harm that the aggressor does to himself.
Well, I tried to. Could I explain the harm that the aggressor does to himself and not just to the victim? I tried to indicate in a brief statement that the initiator of force has to violate every virtue. He has to turn himself into the antithesis of every virtue. He has to become an embodiment of dependence, self-doubt, injustice, dishonesty, parasitism, you name it, every corruption. I indicated to you the pattern. And this is inherent in the fact that he is rejecting reason as his means of dealing with others. So he is thereby rejecting reason as the principle guiding his behavior. So he is throwing out man's means of survival. Now, so then the only question is, what would you take as the definition of harm, of harming yourself, if you accept life as the standard of value and agree that the reason is the primary means of survival and rationality the primary virtue? By definition, then, there is no greater harm a person can do than to say, I'm going to live by some means other than my means of survival. That it was exactly tantamount, and I think this is Mr. Rand's own example, to a animal trying to survive by the means of a plant. If it simply planted its legs in the ground and said, now I'm going to grow, you know, like a plant, And this, a man who tries to survive by force is exactly trying to survive by an animal means. He's throwing out the human means of survival, but he's a conceptual being, so he doesn't have the automatic programming of an animal. So he's just like an animal that plants himself in the ground and tries to grow like a plant. Now that certainly is a good down payment on how he's harming himself.